I had an opportunity to go to World Youth Day in Germany in 2005. It was an excellent opportunity in many ways, and I didn't really want to ruin it. One of the beautiful things about World Youth Day is that in addition to our Holy Father going to that particular site and celebrating that Mass with the people, many organizations will bring incredible treasures of the Church to the same town. So if you get one of the special maps that they make out for World Youth Day, you can discover that there are an incredible number of other treasures offered as well. Notable treasures included the Heart of St. John Vianney, just various things that usually don't travel at all. The Heart of St. John Vianney actually stays in Arles, France. It doesn't go anywhere. No one gets to take it on tour, except certain World Youth Days, they bring it out, and people get a chance to witness it. I remember having free time one day and going down, I called it Church Row. They probably had a real name for it. I just called it Church Row because there were four Catholic churches in the space of two city blocks, so apparently they really liked to live close together but not share churches. It's just a little joke, I promise. In the various churches were art, paintings, and depictions, incredible ones at that. Some of them on cloth, some of them on stone, some of them on canvas, and easy enough to see. And curiously enough, I mean, this is all religious art. And I remember going into the one church and seeing a depiction of the crucifixion. Now, we've all seen pictures of the crucifixion, or images of the crucifixion. It's nothing new, and it was, in every sense, what you might expect. Christ was in the center, hanging on the cross, suffering in his agony. Near the cross were soldiers. Beyond the soldiers were, who I assume, were Mary and John and a few others, mostly women. And then beyond that, in the image, were people standing nearby, but they were in Renaissance garb. And I thought, I don't think that's how they dressed in the time of Christ. It's not exactly the kind of thing you see. Never seen Mary in poofy sleeves, you know? These are just things that you just don't necessarily see. And I thought it was kind of interesting. I discovered later, and through some study of my own, that very often in the Renaissance, people would commission the artist to paint the crucifixion as it stands. But then they would want themselves painted into the image as well. And this wasn't a pompous thing, this wasn't an arrogance, but actually the intention behind it was that they wanted to be with Christ in his suffering. If you think about it, it almost seems kind of curious. Why would anyone necessarily want to suffer with Christ? Why would anyone want to be there with Christ? And yeah, we talk about uniting our sufferings with Christ and being close to that, but there's another part that keeps asking, well, it's not like we can make his suffering go away by being there. It's not like we can make it hurt any less by being there. But I think there's something very telling about the image and our desire to want to be present in that someone else is suffering. Because we don't have to suffer it alone. If you think about it, that's exactly what's contained within each of these scriptures. We have right here out of the Book of Kings this widow in Sidon. This widow in Sidon who accuses God, or accuses Elijah specifically, you know, why did you kill my son? I mean, that's actually what it boils down to. Why have you done this to me, O man of God? Why take away my son from me? It's that lashing out in anger. It's that in that moment of hurt and suffering, we want to even lash out, even with people around us. And I think it's even more important to know the limitations that widows faced, especially during the time of Christ and before in the kingdom of Israel. You see, women couldn't hold traditional jobs. They couldn't hold anything that actually paid a living wage. Sometimes they could do some things that keep a little wage along. If you read books like Tobit, you discover that other nations allowed for women to have some jobs that could pay for things. But by and large, in the kingdom of Israel, in that area, not just Israelites themselves, because the land of Canaan and some of the other neighbors as well, women couldn't work. Not outside the home, anyway. And so their capacity for wage earning without a husband was zero. And so for a widow, if she didn't have a son, she was doomed to have nothing. They had a social structure built in. The direct intention of of the reality they face. At harvest season, when the farmers went through, they only were allowed to make one pass through their fields. Anything that fell behind or they didn't grab on the first reap, they had to leave in the field. Now, that doesn't sound all that difficult with today's technology, because I don't think farmers have to make a second pass through their fields. But if you did it all by hand, you don't catch everything on the first grab, and they purposely left the rest in the field because orphans and widows were entitled to go through the field afterwards and collect that little leftover. That's what they lived on, just that little bit. There wasn't much. And so for this widow in Zion, to lose her son was to lose her ability to live. And here she is in her grief, and she lashes out at Elijah, and Elijah takes the child out and restores life to the child. But I think even just as incredible as life being restored to the dead is this reminder that Elijah didn't necessarily want the widow to suffer. It was never the intention of Elijah to want the widow to suffer. It's not God's intention that we have to take, great tragedy upon us. It's not the direct effect. We suffer, and it's a reality of who we are. But it doesn't seem to be the intention. It doesn't really seem to be what's desired. Consider the gospel. We have contained within this gospel the very reality of the widow of Nain. She is a widow, and here she is. She's lost her son. The story seems to suggest she's lost her only son. I don't know that for sure, but we'll take the indications from the author. And what does God do? Well, he doesn't want us to suffer alone. And he restores life to the child. I think it's an incredible reminder to us that suffering's going to happen. Now, not all of us have to lose our children to be reminded of that. And certainly, I hope not all of you are widows. There are men still sitting in the pews, so at least there's hope for that. The great truth of the matter is that whether or not we are feeling alone, we don't have to suffer alone. God is always present to us. God is always caring. Even in times of hurt and loss and bereavement and separation, God does truly care and is genuinely concerned about us. And in that silence, in the quiet, God is present. And we don't have to suffer by ourselves. Now, I realize that sometimes that comes as small consolation because you want someone there. So you can lash out like Elijah and blame them and think that it's their fault. But I think it's at times like those that we need to remember that if we know of somebody who's suffering, if we know of somebody who's struggling, well, then let's think like the Renaissance, who commissioned those painters long ago. Let's go be present to the people who suffer as well. Just because we're there doesn't mean we can make the suffering go away. Doesn't mean we can change what has happened. Doesn't mean we can ease the pain. But if you know somebody who's suffering, if you know somebody who's struggling, take this week as a reminder, as a challenge, that they shouldn't have to suffer alone. Be present to those people. Because maybe you're God's agent there, sent to be that reminder that nobody, nobody